This morning, this evening's lesson is going to be a part two of the lesson we started this morning, Love Without Hypocrisy, and this was focused more on 1 Corinthians 13, as was read for us a few minutes ago. The Bible emphasizes the work of love, contrasted with the feeling of love, as we talked about today. You know, love is something that's very practical, and it's something that has to be applied. It's not something that's abstract. It has a real meaning, but today, you know, people use it in kind of an abstract way. In today's language, you can love canned spinach. I don't know anybody does, but you can, and you can love your couch, which I do, or you could love your dog, or you can love your mom, and you can say that about all those different things. But you know, each way that you use that is, it's, I hope that you love your mom more than you love canned spinach, and you love your wife more than you love your couch. But, you know, we say those things and we mean different things when we say them. So we know we don't mean exactly the same thing every time we make those statements. But when we talk this morning about agape love, we understand in the context of that kind of love, that's the kind of love that Christ showed us when he died for us on the cross. So in the context of very real events and very real relationships that we have, we understand that love it exhibits itself in different ways. And in Romans, 1 Corinthians, rather, chapter 13 is very read for us. It provides 15 specific characteristics of love that show that really is a contrast to the way the Corinthians are behaving. Because what Paul shows in 1 Corinthians 13 is the way he wants them to behave, but it's not the way that they're acting. They're not treating each other in that way. If you remember our lessons in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, there's a lot of rebuke that goes toward the Corinthians. And so he's told them the way that they are behaving. Now he's telling, here's the way I want you to be. In Hodges' commentary, he says it this way: those traits of love are therefore adduced which stood opposed to the temper which they exhibited in the use of their gifts. They were impatient, discontented, envious, inflated, selfish, unmindful of the feelings or interest of others, suspicious, resentful, and censorious. And you see that the things that are stated, they really do define the way the Corinthians were behaving toward one another. And when you look at this passage, 1 Corinthians 13, no doubt you have heard this talked about as a prism, that love here is a prism, that we're talking about love, but it's broken up into its component parts. And so Paul shines love through this prism. We see all of its hues, each part of the spectrum. And so each part of this gives you a different perspective or a different property of agape love. And so we're gonna look at these things one by one in the lesson tonight. And what we see is that these different words, they don't really focus on what love is so much, but what love does. Or what love does not do. So agape love is something that's active. It's not passive. It's not abstract. It's not a feeling. It's something that we have to have. It's something that needs to be practiced. And so it's very definable, and I think that's what Paul does here in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. So, first of all, we know that love suffers long, or is long-suffering. And the word suffers long literally comes from two words meaning long-tempered, meaning the quality of self-restraint in the face of provocation, which does not hastily retaliate or promptly punish. And, you know, we live in a society today where we see that all around us, where as soon as something is said, then there is a swift reaction. And that's one thing that when we see tragedies such as has happened in the last few days, that even before the facts are gathered, you know, there's people that are already reacting or they're placing blame on one party or another, on a politician or some organization. And so you're just waiting for something to happen so you can blame this particular person or situation. And so that's never good to see those kind of swift reactions before, you know, something is learned about a situation. That's what long-suffering means here. It's meant that we don't hastily retaliate. And it certainly is not helpful when we see that all around us today. You know, we have the power to retaliate. We certainly have the power to use our tongues many times when we shouldn't, or we get on the keyboard or emailing or Facebooking or Twitter or something when we don't really need to do that. But sometimes people are wronged over and over again. There are those that mistreat them, and it's difficult for people to stand up to that. Now, the Greeks saw it as a virtue not to tolerate any insult. And I don't know why that would be virtuous, but there's some people that feel that way, that I'm not going to take that. I'm not going to tolerate anything that's used against me. I'm ready to strike back. And we use terms like when we stand up for our rights. You know, nobody's going to treat me that way. Nobody's going to insult me. And sometimes brethren, unfortunately, behave that way. If they are wronged, then they are armed and ready to retaliate and ready to punish. But we're told to be long-suffering. Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 4, verse 2, "Preach the word, be ready in season, out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching." And it's interesting that these things are put together here, because Paul is telling him to convince and rebuke. And you think, you know, those are things that are active. You see a problem and you're going to fix that. But Paul is saying, even when you see something that needs to be fixed, if you see somebody that needs to be convinced, if you see a situation that needs to be rebuked, you don't go attack it like a pit bull. You have to use some restraint. You have to use some long-suffering. You also have to mix in some teaching there too. And so I've told you before that my mother would read some of the articles or the letters that my dad would write to address certain situations. He may be in a heated conversation with somebody on the other end, and she reads the letter and she says, "Well, you may win the argument, but you're not going to win the man." It's because he would say things that needed to be toned down. He needed to be more long-suffering or soft in the way that he approached something. And so we need to keep that in mind. And God really is the standard for long-suffering, and I think that's something that we can all be happy about. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, Peter says, "The Lord is not slack concerning His promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." Aren't you glad that God doesn't immediately strike us dead? You know, if we sin or if we get out of line, you know, I would not be teaching you, and you would not be here being taught if that were the case. You know, Robert Ingersoll, who you may have heard of, was a well-known atheist in the last century, and he would often stop in the middle of lectures where he was preaching against God and say, "I'll give God 5 minutes to strike me dead for the things that I've said." And he'll wait, and of course he's not struck dead. And then he uses that as a fact that he wasn't struck dead as proof that God doesn't exist. And one took issue with him on that and said, "You know, did you think that you could exhaust the patience of God in 5 minutes? You know, did you think you could exhaust the patience of the eternal God that quickly?" And certainly we understand that God is long-suffering toward us. And we can, if we've learned anything in our studies of the Old Testament, we can certainly see that God has constantly been long-suffering with His people, and is that way with us. So love suffers long is one of the components of love. Love is also kind. Kindness is really a complement to long-suffering. Kindness is something that should be paying back an injury with something that's good. Rather than returning evil for evil, we're going to return good for evil. Literally in the Greek, what this phrase means is to show oneself useful. And that's what this kindness is. It's more than just having a happy attitude or somebody thinking that you're sweet and kind. It's actually doing kind things, doing kind deeds. We see this in the Old Testament. One of the reasons that Boaz was drawn to Ruth but was because of her kindness to her mother-in-law. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 11, Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before." Now, Jarell and I were just talking recently about a particular person that we know who was engaged for a short time to someone. And when she went to his home, to his family, he saw that the way that he behaved in the presence of his family, that he sat on the couch and he waited for everybody in the family to wait on him. And it was kind of a stark difference from the way that she had seen him behave in the past, and saw that, you know, he wasn't kind to anyone. He was sitting there wanting to extract kindness from everyone else. And she saw that maybe that's not the person that I want to be with. And so what Boaz saw was kindness. Boaz saw kindness, and he admired that and was drawn to the kindness that she showed to her mother-in-law. We also see this as one of the criteria that Abraham's servant used kindness as a test when choosing a mate for Isaac in Genesis chapter 24, verse 14. "Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, 'Please let down your pitcher that I may drink,' and she says, 'Drink, and I will also give your camels a drink,' let her be the one that you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master." And again, kindness is a standard thing with God. In Titus chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, "But when the kindness and the love of our God, our Savior, toward man appeared, not by works of righteousness which we have done, but according to His mercy, He saved us through the washing of regeneration, the renewing of the Holy Spirit. God's kindness was shown in Jesus." So kindness is a very focal point of love, and something that is an outgrowth of the love we should show toward one another. Also, love does not envy. Love does not envy. Envy is something that's closely related to jealousy, and jealousy is, you know, wanting something that somebody else has, and envy is wishing they didn't have it either. And you know, this word zelos that it comes from means to boil. It just makes you so mad that you could just boil over with this kind of emotion. And it's really a sin that's acquainted with all other kinds of sin. We see it in the beginning when Cain had that attitude toward Abel, when Abel's sacrifice was something that was pleasing to God. We see Cain boiling against Abel. We see Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers because, you know, he was such the favorite of his father, and they all knew that, and he received the preferential treatment. And so they take care of that situation. And we also see that in the death of Jesus, how, you know, the spiritual leaders of that day, that they just envied and were jealous of Jesus, and they plotted against him. Love doesn't do that. Love does not envy. Love is not jealous. James chapter 3, verse 14, "But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there." And you remember this morning as we talked about what Jesus said about the commandments, that they're all summed up into two: you love God and you love your neighbor. You can see how these things are against loving your neighbor. And is it something that can exist in us? Can we be envious? Well, we shouldn't, because love does not do that. But how do we feel sometimes when we hear of another's success? Yeah, it's hard sometimes when you're on Facebook a lot and you see how much fun everybody else is having on their vacation, right? You know, I'm so happy that they got to take that trip overseas. I'm so happy that they got to do those things. I don't know that that's always our attitude when we see those things. Maybe there's a part of us that's a little envious, and we think, you know, why do they get to do that, or How are they getting to do that? But love does not behave that way. Love is also not boastful. It's not puffed up. And the root word, you know, for this, for the Greek word for boastful, means windbag. Person that's puffed up. And also the same word is used to define the word bellows. And you know what a bellow is? It's something that helps, you know, put air on a fire to make the fire go. And so certainly being called a windbag, if you've ever been called that, it's not a compliment. Being called boastful and puffed up, you know, not a compliment either. So pride really is the problem here. Pride is a real enemy of love. And we've talked about that in Romans, how, you know, pride is addressed right there in the beginning of the book of Romans. We're all tempted to think of ourselves too highly and think of ourselves too much. For I say through the grace given to me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly according as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. So the Bible emphasizes the humility that love should have. And, you know, we should always be aware of how blessed we are to be in certain situations. Instead of thinking, I deserve this. I'm so proud of this because I deserve the great wife that I have. Instead of thinking, I am so blessed to be with this person. I'm so blessed that this person is by my side to help me, you know, through this life. Never thinking that you're all that. And so, you know, this the seed of destruction of love, the seed of destruction of a congregation, the seed of destruction for a marriage, in just about every walk of our life is being too prideful. It never comes across well. It's not admired. Nobody is ever admired for how stuck up and conceited and puffed up and what a blowfish they are. You know, nobody is ever admired for that. Love is not boastful. Love is not puffed up. Love also, and it's very, very much related, I believe, is that love does not behave rudely. And you could understand why somebody that's puffed up and conceited would behave rudely. Another translation says that love has good manners. And I don't know that we know what that is these days, but you can look it up. Your grandparents will tell you what good manners are. But, you know, the root word here carries the idea of being unformed or being shapeless, which means that you just aren't where you need to be. And rudeness seems to be, you know, pretty insignificant to a lot of people these days. You know, one thing that you notice when you go to Chick-fil-A, you know, I don't know how Chick-fil-A does it. They don't have that big of a menu, but they get you through really quickly when you go there. I mean, the drive-thru can look like it's a quarter of a mile long, but you get through there faster than you get through McDonald's, and there's two cars. And they treat you with respect, usually, don't they? They always tell you, my pleasure. And I've noticed Burger King's picked up on that, too. They've started to say, my pleasure, at Burger King. They stole it from Chick-fil-A. But they're trying to not behave rudely. They're trying, and it means something when people do that. They don't behave rudely. And the root word here means that you're not going to behave in that particular way. Rudeness may, you know, you wonder how, what does that have to do with love? But what rudeness says is, I don't care about you. I don't love you because I don't care about what affects you. And that's what rudeness says. You know, that certainly is one of the things that can upset parents, upset mothers when their children are rude to them. I mean, Ann, is that right? Yeah. and we all see that. I'm not saying we see that with your kids, but I'm saying we all see that in general, that when, you know, there's rudeness there, it's it's noticeable, and it's not right. And it's not right for anybody. It's not right for kids. It's not right for adults either. And Christians who are rude in the way that they speak to others, especially with those whom they might disagree, and then pretend that they love them as brothers and sisters, you know, it doesn't add up. So rudeness and ill manners indicate selfishness. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, "Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous," or don't be rude, if you want to put it in another way. Love also does not seek its own. Love does not seek its own. In Romans chapter 6, we see that Paul tells us that we need to think of ourselves as slaves. And what he means by that is that we're a slave of one thing or another. We're either going to be a slave of evil or we're going to be a slave to God. He says, "What then? Are we to sin because we are not under law but under grace? By no means. Do you not know that if you present yourself to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to unrighteousness. But thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed, and having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness. I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations, for just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness." And so what Paul is saying there basically is that you are slaves to one thing or another. That at one point you were slaves to sin and unrighteousness. Now you're a slave to righteousness. And so that is important as we understand that we do not seek our own, that we see ourselves not as our own, that we are completely in control of ourselves. We can do whatever we want, that we have rights. And you hear those that have that attitude today. But what we need to realize is that our welfare is not our primary concern. Sometimes when a young person says to another person that "I love you," they mean "I love me and I want you." We mentioned that this morning. "I want you to make me happy." And a marriage counselor once said, if you want to be happy, you know, then don't get married. The only reason to get married is to make someone else happy. I think that you can see some wisdom in that advice. The reason to get married is not to make yourself happy, but to make someone else happy. You know, if both people are doing that, it's going to work out, right? And so that's part of love, not seeking its own. Also, love is not provoked. The Greek word for provoked means to sharpen or to stimulate or to stir up. Some translations say not easily provoked, meaning that there's anger that doesn't arise too quickly. Basically, love is not ready to fight. It doesn't feel insecure or threatened, and always willing to pick a fight or to jump into a fight. Also, we see that love thinks no evil. Love thinks no evil. The world thinks that it's an accountant's job to keep track of things, to keep inventory. But you know, a lot of people keep inventory of things. People record things in their mind. And what Paul is saying here is love does not keep a record of wrong done against it. And this is the same word that's used when we're describing the pardoning act of God in Romans chapter 4 and verse 8. "Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin." It's talk about us being pardoned from sin, that God's not going to remember that. And sometimes we are quick to believe evil about others. I've used the illustration before. The congregation that we used to attend was in a shopping center on Valleydale Road, and two doors down from the congregation was a liquor store. And somebody that if you knew me and you saw me walking toward that store, what would you think? Well, there goes Randy going to the liquor store again. Now, you would probably think he's going to the church building. Maybe you'd think I was going to the liquor store if you were thinking evil. Love, if you love me, you wouldn't think that, you automatically assume, there goes Randy, he's going to the liquor store. You wouldn't think that about me. And so, you know, there's been times with my phone that I've told my phone to do something or to call somebody. And just recently I told it to Siri, call Steve Miranda. He's somebody that I work with. And something obscure came up on my phone. It actually came up with a definition of an insulting word. And we kind of laughed about it at the office because I said Steve Miranda and this insulting word came up. And I don't know how it translated my text to speech to come up with that. But, you know, I'm saying Siri's not assuming the best thing. Siri is not assuming that I asked for something nice and it gave me something not nice. So, do we ever do that as Christians? That somebody may say something, somebody may do something, and somebody puts the worst possible construction on that event or on that comment. And, you know, love doesn't do that. Love also, and this is very much related to that, love rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices with the truth. Love does not take pleasure in sin. It rejoices when truth is found, and it doesn't gloat over sin. It certainly doesn't rejoice in the sin that it sees in others. It should be something that causes us to mourn over the lost. And so, love doesn't overlook sin, is not what we're saying. But we're not seeking to jump on somebody. That we are seeking to attack someone. We would certainly want to help somebody that's in sin. You don't take pleasure in sin. You don't rejoice, aha, I knew that they were going to do that. I knew that they were going to leave the Lord. I knew they were going to treat their wife or their husband badly. And somehow it seems like brethren can sometimes rejoice in evil that they see because it confirmed their fears or it confirmed a thought that they had about someone or something. And certainly I would rather be wrong about those things. I would not want to be confirmed in thinking something evil of someone else and rejoice in evil. Love also bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The word translated bear here from bearing all things comes from a word which means to protect or to preserve through covering. And in short, love will do everything it can do to protect someone else or to cover someone else. It's not ready to denounce. It's ready to give the benefit of the doubt and believe good things first and hope for good things in the future. And even when things don't turn out for good, that love will endure. That's what is being said here. I don't think I have ever heard this said in a marriage ceremony. But you know, it might not be a bad idea to say to each other, don't give up on me. I won't give up on you, you don't give up on me. And you may think, well, that's assuming that things are going to be bad. But no, it's assuming a commitment. It's assuming that we're going to be committed, just as we are committed as brethren to one another. You know, we have a relationship together. We don't give up on each other. We're all working toward the same goal. And so that's what we want here at Elliottsville. That's what we want as brothers and sisters. I don't want you to give up on me, and you don't want me to give up on you, and we all help each other grow. And that's why, you know, if these things are done, then love never fails. if we do what 1 Corinthians 13 says to do, it's really because God first loved us, and when we see how much He loved us, we love each other in the same way, and it's not going to fail. You know, the Corinthian brethren had lots and lots of work to do, and the things that Paul told them to do in 1 Corinthians 13 were really the opposite of much of the way that they were treating each other. But they needed to put that aside and do things in a new way. And it's a good encouragement for us as well as we go through this study together. If we can help you in any way to be obedient to the gospel of Christ, we invite you to come as we stand together and sing.